Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. This week we're going to be talking about James Cameron's 1986 sequel to Ridley Scott's Alien, Aliens. Before we get to that, let's do a little housekeeping. I want to just talk about a couple of responses I got back for the Godzilla podcast. I got one response from someone named TimZilla1122 from the Godzilla subreddit on Reddit. And he said, quote, "I really enjoyed your podcast, but Gojira is a much better film than you made it out to be. I agreed with all of your points on the other two movies, though. If you haven't listened to that podcast, I compared the original 1954 Ishiro Honda Godzilla to the two American remakes, Roland Emmerich's 98 remake and Gareth Edwards' 2014 remake." So another entry in the same subreddit, Captain_Failure. "I highly disagree with your assessment of the original film. Honda's film wasn't attempting to be Hollywood, but rather a commentary on the dangers of nuclear weapons." I kind of want to speak to briefly just both of these. What this podcast is about is sort of film and the way film does or does not work. I talk a lot about the intent of the filmmaker versus actually what happens on the screen. And I agree that Honda tried to make a really serious film about nuclear war and using the metaphor of Godzilla. And I still think it's a very special film. I think it's worth canonizing and worth... Criterion did a wonderful remaster on it. And he set the tone for kaiju films, the way he shot things. There's a lot of really bad things in the film. There's a lot of bad directing, some bad editing. From my perspective, there's a lot of really bad acting. So a lot of things don't work in the film. They come across as really goofy. So that's it for housekeeping. And thanks to anyone who takes the time to write feedback, because I'm kind of in my room doing this, and I love doing it, and it's fun, and you know, I can see people downloading, but I love feedback and your comments either way. All right, let's get into a bit of the background for Cameron's Aliens. Alien producer David Giler declared back in 79, immediately after Alien was released, that his production company immediately wanted to make a sequel to Ridley's film. They had the full support of 20th Century Fox president Alan Ladd Jr. But that year, Ladd left during a corporate shakeup. I think Fox was bought by new owners and new management, and they were not interested in a sequel. So Giler accused this new incoming president of being the one that held up the film's production. But that guy, Norman Levy, said later, "It was a movie I wanted to make, but he felt it would be too costly." So in the meantime, Giler and his partners, Walter Hill and Gordon Carroll, sued Fox regarding the disbursement of Alien profits. So by the time the lawsuit was settled in 83, Fox had brand new executives again, and they were interested in continuing Alien. So Giler pitched the project to one of them. Somebody came across Cameron's screenplay for Terminator, and they passed the script to Giler because it hadn't been released yet. And they thought that this is a guy who was apt for the job. And then Giler approached Cameron, who was completing pre-production on the Terminator. He hadn't even filmed it yet. Cameron was a big fan of the original Alien, definitely was interested in crafting a sequel. And he sort of entered a self-imposed seclusion to brainstorm a concept for the second film. After 4 days, he produced a 45-page treatment, which is just amazing to my mind. So then there was a scheduling conflict with Arnold during Terminator. So Terminator was delayed by like 9 months. Arnold was off filming Conan the Destroyer. Cameron now had all this time to write the full script for Aliens. And while he was filming the Terminator, he wrote like 90 pages for Aliens. And though the script wasn't finished, Fox's new president was really impressed and told Cameron that if the Terminator was a success, that the Aliens was his. Cameron even declared that he spent production of The Terminator thinking on what elements of that film could make a good dry run for the Alien sequel. So it was interesting to think about. His focus was kind of split in that he was all in Terminator and doing it. And at the same time, he was already kind of thinking as he was filming, like, would this work for Aliens? Would that not work for Aliens? So very interesting. Cameron said he initially drew inspiration for the Alien story from the Vietnam War. And the notion here is that there was a technologically superior force mired in a hostile foreign environment. And he quotes, quote, their training and technology are inappropriate for the specifics, and that can be seen as analogous to the inability of superior American firepower to conquer the unseen enemy in Vietnam. A lot of firepower and very little wisdom, and it didn't work, end quote. He also listed Robert A. Heinlein's novel Starship Troopers as a major influence, and that was something that I felt the first time I saw this, that in a sense, Heinlein was finally getting his day at the movies, even though it wasn't his story. But it really made me think of that as well. He pulled, you know, a lot of the military terms and a bunch of the terms from that novel, the drop and bug hunt from Starship Troopers, as well as the cargo loader exoskeleton, which is kind of cool as well. Okay, so let's jump into Aliens. It's a very quiet opening. We start in space. We immediately see the shuttle from the Nostromo drifting. And the music here that you're hearing is cribbed from 2001. It's Aram Khachaturian's Gaina Ballet Suite, which is what you're hearing when you first meet the Discovery on the way to Jupiter. Inside the shuttle, you're seeing frost on everything. And we see Ripley in her sleep chamber. He hits a lot of the marks that Ridley set out in Aliens, and there's a nice touch. The ship's computer comes alive, but we only see it reflected in a hibernation glass. And then the words proximity alert are on the computer. And then we see the shuttle dwarfed from above by a much larger ship, which made me think very much Star Wars. Then there's a light from outside. So the camera now is inside the shuttle still. And we see a light from outside peering in. Still no sound. Then we see this industrial robot torch open the hatch. It's very cool because all we see is the welding torch coming through the hatch, and there's this very precise way it cuts open the hatch, so you can tell it's computer controlled, like it makes a hexagon. It's very cool. Still just seeing that happen, lots of smoke, and then the hatch crashes in, and this probe enters and scans the area with this really cool laser, and the lasers interact with the smoke, which is very neat. And then some men enter, and they discover Ripley and Jonesy the cat, and they're disappointed, and they sort of say something about, damn, you know, no salvage, because there's a living, breathing person. Then we cut to, we think we're back on Earth. We're in an orbital station, actually, a gateway station, it's called. And we meet Burke, played by Paul Reiser, entering, bringing Jonesy the cat. We have this scene where Burke has to break it to her that she's been gone 57 years and no one has told her yet. And then Jonesy hisses and we get a full-on chestburster scene from her. And of course, there's a dream sequence and she wakes up. I have to say, like, as much as this movie is classic and I love it, I'm not a fan of the dream sequence in the beginning of the film, the chestburster scene. Like, I feel like it's too soon, you know? Like, he does such a great job in building tension in this whole film that, you know, and most of the people that have seen Aliens have seen the first film, and we kind of know what's going on. So I don't like that he kind of, since there isn't really an intense chestburster scene. I mean, there's one when you get to the planet and we see one person from a distance, but I don't know. He felt like he had to put it in. I'm not a big fan of it, I have to say. It's definitely a nit in this movie, for sure, but I didn't think he needed it. And it takes away, in a sense, of her getting the information that she's been gone 57 years. That's cut short as we go into this chestburster scene. So, you know, when she finally does wake up, there's an initial moment of like, okay, was she dreaming about the 57 years? Was she dreaming about, you know, like, it introduces just like a little bit of an uncertainty into things. I'm never a big fan of it anyway. Then we're in this briefing, the briefing room. She's being grilled about the destruction of the Nostromo in front of this committee, a $42 million ship, they're told. There's a cool little detail. You know, we're in a bit in the future now, and suit styles or the collars on the suit jackets are all up, which is just a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a twist, making you realize that we're kind of, you know, not in the present day, even though most of it is the same in suits and ties and that sort of thing. It's very cool. So at this inquest, they tell her they can't find any evidence to corroborate her story about an alien being loose on the ship. And the fact that he destroyed the ship was such a colossal loss to the company. And since she's the sole survivor, they went over the shuttle with a fine-tooth comb. They didn't find any evidence of the xenomorph in the shuttle in any way. So, you know, she wakes up after, you know, 57 years at a briefing and gets kind of cashiered. And she kind of loses it at the end and she gets really angry. and telling them that there are hundreds of eggs on that planet, you know, and you have to go back there and so on and so forth. And then after the meeting, she's told that there are up to 70 families on what is now called LV-426, and there have been for 20 years, and there's been no problems. Immediately, you know, she's completely discredited in a sense. And so there's an indeterminate period of time, and Ripley has been downgraded in her career. She no longer has flight status. She works in a loader. You know, she's working on the docks, and she lives in a real poor section of Gateway Station. One day, Burke and a Marine lieutenant named Gorman visit her. They tell her that they've lost contact with the colony. And she asks a good movie story question, which a viewer would ask, like, why her? Right, and of course, you know, we get the answer. She's the only one who's dealt with them, and it kind of makes sense in a way. And you know, and she so refuses completely. Now Burke sweetens the deal and says, if you go, you'll be reinstated as a flight officer, and you'll have your career back. So he's, you know, kind of playing her a bit. And we hear Burke telling her that I've read your psych evals, and that she wakes up every night bathed in sweat from the, you know, all the traumatic experience that took place earlier. And of course, now we cut to that night. She wakes up in the middle of it, bathed in sweat, screaming, and she's crying because she basically has like the chest burster dream every night. And so she calls Burke through this video phone and tells him, okay. And I like that the video phone is really grainy. There's certain smart things in sci-fi movies that directors do where even though it's futuristic tech, it's not bright and shiny. The video phone that they're using for Burke, you don't really see him that well. And I'm sure they could have made it perfect, but I think Cameron was smart in understanding, you know, the dirtier your high tech is, the cooler and more realistic it is. Because this is James Cameron, man, the story is lean and mean. We cut immediately to the Sulaco, which is the marine starship. Little side note, the Nostromo was the ship in the original Alien, and the Nostromo was a novel written by Joseph Conrad about a silver mining town in South America, fictional, of course, and the town was called Sulaco. So Cameron keeping with the theme of everything. It looks like a flying gun. I mean, it's really wild looking. It looks like one of their pulse rifles, you know, with 1,000 extra antennas on it. Very cool. We get a little martial drumming music underneath. So we know, you know, we're in military time now. And then we get the same kind of thing that we got with Ridley's Alien, the same silence. The ship's computer wakes up, and then the different sleep chambers this time, they're a little more rugged and chunky, as befitting their military use. And we see this whole platoon come out of sleep. We meet Apone, who's played by a real-life actual Marine who saw combat in Vietnam. His name is Al Matthews, and he's very good. He's very charismatic. And this is the classic, you know, Cameron really did a great job here with, like, movie Marine dialogue. Lots of fun, you know, and he continues his streak of kick-ass female characters, so not just Ripley. In The Terminator, we had Sarah Connor, now we have Ripley, and now we also have Vasquez. She's so cool. She's a fellow smart gun operator with her buddy Drake. Get to the smart gun as we go, and she's awesome. I think she's played by Jeanette Goldstein is the woman's name. She actually, side note, was in Terminator 2, she played John's stepmom, and who actually the T2 morphs into, unknown to her husband, and there's that great scene of, you know, her stabbing the husband through the mouth with steak knife arm. Same character, same actress. Cameron's sticking to Ridley's template so far here, waking up for hypersleep, the first meal, the chatter. You know, it's not the ultra-realism Truckers in Space that we got, for sure. Like, this is a Hollywood movie, and the dialogue's a little more Hollywood. But it's cool. It's good. It's great movie Marines in Space. Like, to me, it's not as convincing in terms of, like, I'm, you know, Aliens, I'm almost watching a documentary at times. But it's so good. I mean, the Marines are great. The dialogue is great. It's just, it's crackling good. And all the principals are great. You know, Hudson is great. There's Hicks, played by Michael Biehn, also from Terminator. It's awesome. So it's like, it's just different. It's just a different style. It's a little more Hollywood, but it's awesome. And it works just as well for what it's doing, you know. So then we cut to the flight line. You know, they're on the deck. And Gorman does the initial listen up people kind of talk, and he mistakes Hudson for Hicks, so we realize that he's really a green lieutenant. He doesn't, and we, you can tell here, he really doesn't know the squad, and the guy playing Gorman was great, because he really is, look, he's kind of a stick in the mud. And so he has Ripley brief the troops about what's going to happen, and it's great, because she's kind of going through it, and you can tell she's still struggling with it emotionally, but then Vasquez interrupts her and basically says, all I need to know is where they are. And, you know, she gets slaps from the other Marines. But there's a great moment here where Ripley, like, walks up to her, and she doesn't sweat Vasquez at all. She's like, I hope you're right. I hope we're, you know, I hope you guys are just going to wipe the floor with them. But she's totally, like, not intimidated by these Marines because of what she's been through. She doesn't believe that they're going to have any real effect. They've run into these things. So it's neat. And the loading bay on the Sulaco set, it's a terrific set. I mean, it looks great. You know, the dropships are there. There's lots of cables and riggings and cranes. And we see this character, Spunkmeyer, loading what looks like a couple of tactical nukes or just, you know, missiles on the dropship using an exoskeleton sort of loading machine where, your body goes in the thing and you're using hands and legs and so on and so forth. It's a wonderful design. You know, Cameron, from Terminator to this movie, really his machines, the things that, and, you know, he's an artist, so he's obviously coming up with these things himself and sketching them to be made, and he's a brilliant production designer as well as a really good director and a writer, and it's just spot on. It all looks really good and really realistic. So there's this great moment where Ripley walks up to Apone. She's like, what can I do? And he's like, well, I don't know, what can you do? Just totally like, get out of my face, lady. And she's like, I can drive that loader. So they all watch her. Apone and Hicks watch her strap into the loader as she's strapping in and like doing the pre-flight, you know, like Hicks is smiling. She lumbers over to them and picks up the crate and looks at Apone. She's like, where do you want it? And they both start laughing as she lumbers off with this crate. And it's great. I mean, what a great character moment. And this is part of this, the brilliant writing in this, that because of how she was treated and that she got cashiered, she went and learned how to drive these things and had this horrible however many months where she had to be this sort of dock worker and operate these things. And yet, she has the skill now that's going to come in handy, you know, by the end of the film as well. And it's just really cool. You know, it's just like the first moment of like, you don't mess around with Ripley, man, because she can do it all, you know. You know, she doesn't turn into a superwoman. You know, we see her slowly acquire the skills to be this action hero, which she definitely becomes by the end of the movie. This is great, you know, as they're starting to do weapons tech. We see Vasquez and Drake, and they have these amazing repeater weapons called smart guns. They're mounted on the rigs that real filmmakers use for Steadicams, when you do Steadicam shots, you know, when you're walking with people and, you know, the camera's right in there. It's really great. I mean, what Cameron did in a regular army, they would be called the saw gunners, which is called a squad automatic weapon. You know, each squad would have a soldier with a heavy machine gun to lay down suppressing fire. What an innovation. He uses the Steadicam rigs and just throws like these miniguns on there. And it's so smart. And the guns are really cool. We see them moving them around. And we also see a tank-like transport, this vehicle. It's like a super Batmobile that they go into, you know, into battle with. It's really cool. I think it was an aircraft loader in real life, and they kind of souped it up and did all kinds of, you know, exterior changes to it. But it's a really cool transport vehicle. And then we get the whole muster, you know, they're into the dropship and the music's kicking in and they're spinning up the turbines and very adrenaline pumping. You know, Hudson's like express elevator to hell going down and all these great, you know, effects, and everyone's talking to each other. They find out that this is only Gorman's second combat jump. So, you know, more to his character of the lieutenant doesn't know shit. And the effects are definitely dated here. You know, they use models, so they don't, you know, they don't look fake, but the backgrounds, the mating of the model with the background mats are, it's not very seamless. So you can tell that you're looking at a really good model, but the background is kind of cheesy. So it doesn't date that well, these scenes. But you notice there's a couple of little things here. The dropship has a cartoon painted on it, a bug stomper, which I think is a great detail. The pilot wears, this woman wears mirror sunglasses, and there's stuff written on her helmet. Like I think Cameron told them to probably personalize their gear, which they did a lot, which guys did in Vietnam all the time, drawing shit on their helmets. And so it's really cool. And we're introduced in the drop that every soldier has a helmet camera. Gorman's checking them as they're prepping, and this will come into play later on. Really cool. You know, you get these helmet cam shots as they go into battle. And this is, again, from Ridley, you know, because there were helmet cam shots in Alien. Not many, but just when they were out exploring. And the camera just souped it up. I mean, the time he spent thinking this through, you know, that he took every element that Ridley laid out in Alien and he just put a great twist on it continuously. Like, he just, it's like the template of what a sequel really can be, you know, of staying true to the original film's core soul. But like, Cameron, in every little detail, used what the original film trotted out and improved upon it. You know, I wouldn't say improved upon it, but he expanded it. Let's put it that way. He expanded the concept to fit the new story that he was trying to tell, which is just, I don't think he's ever been better as a writer than in this film. Just incredible. They're close to landing, and we see from, you know, some exterior grainy shots, these massive atmosphere generators. He's doing what Ridley did, different kinds of shots. We're getting regular filmic shots of the complex. We're getting grainy shots from cameras. Then through the pilot's windshield that is raining, so they're kind of fuzzy. Really cool, you know, just keeping us kind of guessing. So then the first of the great tension-setting scenes, it's raining out. The Marines deploy around the, you know, the complex of where the colonists were, which is completely deserted and dilapidated. And it's really, this to me, this is like a Western for a little bit of this movie. You know, this is like a dilapidated Western town and no one's around. It's like a ghost town. And Cameron is great with the deployment of the Marines. We have a guy with a Steadicam, he's in right with the soldiers. So when they're hustling to move up, you're right with them, you know. Cut the lock, they open the doors, and now you're inside. And you have no idea what to expect. You know, is this going to be straight up aliens? And are we going to start fighting right now? The tension is terrific. They're going down these long hallways that are dark. And there's big gashes in the rents are torn in the metal and the, you know, the evidence of a firefight, lots of smashed walls and equipment, and lots of cutbacks to the, you know, the command vehicle that they're sitting in. And so we're seeing helmet cam shots, and they break out the motion trackers, which is another update on Ridley. You know, it's a great tension device, and Cameron uses it to great effect. As Hicks is walking by some melted holes in the decking, Ripley sees it, and she tells him to sort of pan right. And so he focuses in on it, and we hear Burke mutter acid for blood, which kind of now proves her story, that she's now pretty much been vindicated for everything that she said. So then the scene is declared clear. Ripley, Burke, and Gorman now enter from the sort of command vehicle. You know, we're getting a lot of sort of forensic discussion about how they think the colonists made their last stand and they barricaded themselves in. And Cameron really milks it here. They slowly move to the med lab, and we see three tanks. Two of them, three facehuggers. Two of the tanks are, you know, the facehuggers are definitely dead, and one of them is still alive. And Burke gets really close to it, and the thing moves out, trying to get past the glass. And, you know, Burke moves back. And so Bishop picks up some of the clipboards, and he's reading about how, you know, they killed some patients trying to removing some of these things from them, which obviously they didn't do in Alien. But so again, another continuation of how the alien, you know, functions and propagates. So then they finally get motion on the tracker. They're slowly moving down a hallway, and suddenly this form dashes in front of the camera, and Drake opens up with the smart gun, but Hicks spoils it for his aim because he could see it's a little girl. So she runs, they follow her, and Ripley climbs after her through a vent and finds her in this really cool junction area. You know, all of her survival gear. She's got all the stuff that she brought in and food and all this stuff, and she's right under like a, you know, a fan, so probably that, you know, her motion or her life signs were sort of masked from the aliens, and she alone has survived, which is really cool. So now they're all back in ops, and of course, Gorman, the douchey lieutenant, tries questioning her, but very brusquely and, you know, not really giving a shit about what she's been through, and Weaver brushes him back, and there's wonderful writing here, and she cleans her face a little bit, and, you know, Ripley doesn't pander to the kid, right? She's just kind of real with her. Very gentle. It's really good writing, and so Weaver's really great there too. And so Hudson's been looking around for the colonists because he says that they're wearing these. All the colonists are wearing tracking devices implanted under the skin, and he finds them all clustered together at a sort of sub level underneath one of those big atmosphere processors, you know, on the other side of sort of the complex. So now we get our first contact with the xenomorphs. Basically, from this moment until the end of the movie, you're on a ride. I mean, it was all built up until now, and now we're escalating. And Cameron starts here a level of tension that just does not let up until the credits roll. It's pretty impressive when you think about it. They gear up and they get into that command vehicle, and they head down. As they disembark, already their signals are getting fuzzy and faint, kind of being blocked by, you know, all the dense technology in the structure. So, you know, we're getting our first bit of tension that they're not quite be able to be in laser-like touch. And we start getting our first shots of the Giger-like walls of the hive. So we're seeing all this condensation, and as if we were inside a ribcage kind of art direction that was really prevalent in the first film. It looks great on the helmet cams. And again, you know, we get shots from the camera of the actual production design, the actual shot. And then we get these switchovers to the helmet cams from the point of view of Gorman back in the command vehicle. It's really cool. They're heading down, and then Ripley notices that they're in a place where they're, you know, there's this what she calls a primary heat exchangers, and there's this cooling system that's operating, keeping, I guess, the fusion reactor online. If they start firing within this area, you know, the bullets will rupture the cooling system and basically the atmosphere generators, basically a huge fusion bomb. So it's a great escalation of tension, right? And Gorman, you've seen Gorman already start to sweat, you know, and he calls Apone and they have to collect magazines. One of the guys has this great line, "What are we supposed to use, man? Harsh language?" You know, which I just love. There's a lot of great lines here. The two big smart gunners, Vasquez and Drake, you know, they have these sort of secondary firing pins that they keep just to themselves. So they hand their main firing pins to whoever they had the duty. And they both kind of wink and look at each other, and they kind of sneak in their replacement. So they're armed and loaded for bear, which is kind of cool. And, of course, Hicks pulls out a shotgun, and we get another great line. "I like to keep this handy for close encounters." Right, close encounters. Basically, back in 1985, 1986, direct reference to Spielberg's Close Encounters, the third kind, with a shotgun. I thought that was a really a clever wink by Cameron there. And now, I mean, now we're in overdrive. They're walking into the alien nest with a shotgun, flamethrowers, and that's about it, you know? So really, really great escalation here. And so then they come upon some of the colonists stuck in the sort of secretion and the side walls, you know, that the alien secretes to keep, you know, their sort of prey stuck in there while the, you know, eggs mature and hatch. And it's gross, man. You know, and we're seeing empty eggs, and we're seeing like the floor is literally littered with skeletons of dead facehuggers, you know, that have already come out, you know, birthed aliens. And Cameron really takes his time here. You know, he really has learned from Terminator to this film how to really do suspense. Like, you know, Terminator really was an action movie. Like he wasn't patient with Terminator. Like he didn't really wait. You know, there was suspense in some of the final scenes, but boy, is he a master at it now. And at one point, one of the colonists opened their eyes, which is a creepy shot. This woman, and a chestburster comes out of her. She's really gross, and Ripley sees it from the command vehicle, and you know, it's almost like she's reliving it. And they torch it with a flamethrower. As the chestburster screams, all of a sudden they hear all kinds of movement around them. Of course, the, you know, signal movement tracker, there's dozens of signals now closing in. And finally, the attack starts. This is great, man, because this is just like, this is the one time when I don't know where I am or I don't know what's going on in a firefight. It makes sense to me because nobody does. I mean, they're just getting decimated. There's a great setup here where, you know, when you're with Gorman in the command vehicle, you're seeing each of the Marines who gets killed, their signals flatline and their camera goes off. So you're seeing who dies by the signals coming back to Gorman, which is really great. Vasquez and Drake open up with their smart guns and Gorman freaks out who's firing in there. Apone gets killed, so the sergeant is dead. There's a terrific sequence now where it's just helmet cams and screaming and shooting, and no one knows what's going on. You can't tell. There are shots of aliens here and there and shots of, you know, screaming Marines, and nobody knows what they're doing or where to go. Since, you know, in a sense, they discovered the colonists, but now they're under attack. So without any real leadership, they don't really have any orders. So they're kind of just dying there. It's really, really foobar, and it's all control is lost. Ripley finally reacts. I mean, they drag it out for a while. You really get the tension. And Gorman kind of goes into robot mode in a very low voice. He's sort of, you know, mouthing a squad movement instructions that are completely ineffectual. And Ripley kind of flips out. She nearly chokes him. And then she runs to the front of the APC and drives in to get them. And then this is great. He's trying to pull her out of the driver's seat. Burke's trying to pull him off of her. It's mayhem. And then, you know, back with the Marines, you know, they're getting killed. And we don't get a lot of full-on alien shots, which I think is great. You know, we get some here and there, but like it, you know, Cameron's smart. He doesn't do a full reveal yet. You know, there's just movement and texture and shadow and, you know, Marines getting killed, basically. Finally, you know, Ripley makes it all the way down to the third level. She smashes through a bulkhead, and the Marines that are left kind of come back into the APC. And we see Drake sort of, he's taking the rear, and he takes an alien completely apart with a smart gun. Looks really cool, but the blood just is all over him. He just dies there, totally torched. And then there's this last great scene where they're trying to close the doors. First, Hicks has to drag Vasquez back out of the doorway because she wants to go back out after Drake. But Hicks tells her that he's dead. And then finally, they're about to close the door, but an alien gets his hands or her hands in between. And so they're trying to close the door, and they can't because the alien's right there. So Hicks has to blast one with a shotgun. And of course, he gets sprayed with blood himself just slightly. And they finally close the door, and Ripley gets them out of there. So the next couple of sequences are fairly plot-heavy. So I'll just kind of recap the story. You know, in a nutshell, basically, they realize that the Marines that had died back at the firefight were still alive, and we know that because of, you know, the cocooning and the eggs and all that. We have this great, you know, Bill Paxton's, you know, Hudson gets them to, he gets all his great lines, which we all know, game over, we're screwed, we just got our asses kicked, pal. A lot of which I've read about, that were ad-libbed. They decide to nuke the site from orbit. There's a back and forth with Burke about that. We get the sequence of the dropship being destroyed, which is pretty cool. Although it looks a little bit like, you know, when the dropship's coming in, it's on a screen, and our, you know, heroes are actually in a soundstage, so it's a little dated as when you look at it. You get the important plot point of Hicks giving a wrist tracker to Ripley, and then Ripley giving it to Newt, and it sets us up for the last part of the film. And then we get this confrontation between Burke and Ripley where, you know, it's discovered that Burke was the one who sent the colonists out to the ship after he heard Ripley's story when she was revived, but he didn't warn them or send them in there with any protection. And so she has decided, she's kind of set this a little subplot in motion that when they get back to the company, she's going to burn him, which obviously now he needs to protect himself. We also get a clock set up where they, you know, they see this venting of the plasma from one of the atmosphere generators, and Bishop surmises that they've got, you know, maybe about an hour plus left until it goes thermonuclear, which kind of sets up, they were going to nuke the site from orbit, but they have a nuke, you know, counting down, so it's kind of clever. And Bishop has to crawl through this pipe to get to sort of a dish, align it, and remote pilot the ship. And then we kind of leave our crew, you know, in the ops after they've barricaded themselves in, and you know, they're just going to wait out Bishop in the dropship. And of course, the classic line that if I hear it in another sci-fi action movie, I'm going to throw up, which Hicks says to Vasquez and Hudson, "Stay frosty." So then we have this great moment where Hicks teaches Ripley about this, what he calls the M41A pulse rifle. The gun is great too, man. Really good production design here. It really looks real, very tactile. Everything works, you know. He slams a clip in and a little digital number readout reads how many, I think it's 40 rounds in the gun. And there's this funny moment where she's like, "Well, what about this grenade launcher?" And he's like, "Oh, you don't want to mess with that." And she's like, "Show me everything. I can take care of myself." And he's like, "Yeah, I noticed." So, and also, soon after that scene, Gorman is revived, and, you know, he's about to apologize to Ripley, and she says, "Forget about it," and walks past him. So now we kick up the tension into overdrive. Ripley and Newt, you know, Ripley hasn't had any sleep in a long time, so she and Newt crash in one of the med lab bays. They wind up sleeping under the cot. I think Newt crawled under there, and so Ripley crawls in behind her. So she wakes up, and immediately the camera's with them under the cot. We get this great first shot of the empty canisters that house the facehuggers rolling around on the floor. And this is a chilling scene. I mean, even now, still, I watch this scene, and man, I get goosebumps in this one. Ripley wakes up, and the minute she pokes her head up, one of the facehuggers, there's two of them, actually, one of the facehuggers launches it towards her. But she pins it between the wall and the cot. Her and Newt get out of the way. The facehugger scurries off somewhere. We don't know where. And now there's this moment where they're standing in front of these soundproof walls, and the facehuggers are somewhere in the med lab, and they're smashing on the walls. And then there's like a shot from without and from the camera, and we could see that they're making actually no sound. She uses a chair. The camera focuses on the pulse rifle, which she left out on the table outside the room. And then there's this really crazy scene where she waves to the camera, and then we cut to Burke, who's looking at her waving, and he's sweating, and he shuts off the monitor so no one can see her. So she, you know, no glass breaking, incredible tension. You know, it's in the little room with them. It's incredible. Ripley comes up with the idea of the lighter, activates the fire suppression system, And so now they're huddled together, her and Newt. There's lights flashing and rain, you know, coming from the sprinklers. And at one point, you know, Ripley falls over and it's chasing her on the ground. It gets its tail around her neck and is like inches from her face, and she's holding it. And it's slowly, inexorably getting closer to her. We see a second one right behind Newt. It's just like, oh, man. This is like the horror moment. Finally, like, the Marines get there, and they shoot out the glass, and Hicks dives through it. Hudson kills the facehugger that was around Newt. And then, like, all of them are around Ripley, and they grab it, and they hold it, and the legs are kind of closing in and out. Like, it looks so alive. The facehuggers look as good here as they did in the first Alien. I mean, really, you know, animatronic. They look terrific. It's really creepy and wet-looking. And finally, like, on three, they pull it off her throat in a corner and, like, kill it. Man, what a roller coaster ride. That scene, still a really incredible, incredibly tense scene. They grab Burke, and she outlines the plan of Burke's is that, you know, he would have them impregnated. He would have to sabotage the sleep chambers of everyone else on board. So basically what she theorizes is that the aliens would be impregnated, her and Newt. The sleep chambers of Hudson, Vasquez, and Hicks would be sabotaged. They'd be dead. And then when they got back to Earth, Burke could make up any story he wanted, write his ticket, basically. And they're all like, you're dead. And they're about to kill him. And all of a sudden, you know, the perimeter alarm trips. There's this great line before that, actually. Ripley says, I don't know what species is worse. You don't see them fucking each other over for a goddamn percentage. It's a great, great line. So before they can do Burke in, the power goes out. And so the next couple of sequences we get are great. You know, the tracker lights up, and the aliens are sort of inside the complex, and they missed something. And there's a great scene in Ops where they're all huddled together looking at the tracker. And at one point, the aliens are, you know, seemingly inside the room, but of course, you know, they're not. And Hicks pops open the ceiling, and we get this great chilling shot of the aliens are, you know, clinging on to the superstructure of the building above the ceiling, you know, crawling to their location. Pretty terrific shot, for sure. And the firefight ensues, and in that firefight, Hudson dies, covering their rear. And then there's this set of sequences where Burke is continually locking doors, blocking them from getting away. They're cutting through the door, so there's a lot of tension built up there, which is really great. A great way to set up, you know, a lot of tension. You know, Burke, you know, finally gets his demise via an alien. And then Newt points out that the air vents are the way to go. So, and it's genius writing again, right? Because, you know, Newt's character is that she survived all this time in these air ducts. I mean, she's been running around them her whole time there, so she really knows them. So there's no suspension of disbelief when they follow her into the ducts. It's like, of course Newt knows them. Like, this is how she survived. And so in a sense, you know, she's saving their asses. And it makes perfect sense. Like, I don't get that moment of like, oh, the kid's going to solve everything. You know, like, I was prepared for it by the film, so no disbelief needed. And so now we have a basic little bit of a plot now. Vasquez and Gorman cover the rear while Ripley, Hicks, and Newt escape. They die in this. It's kind of a nice movie death where, you know, they realize Vasquez has been injured in her. The acid blood from one of the aliens has destroyed her foot. So her and Gorman just kind of sit there, and they get cut off, and they just kind of pop a grenade. And yours were an asshole, Gorman, is what Vasquez says, and they die. And then we get the loss of Newt, the explosion of their grenade as Newt's traversing this, you know, one area. She drops into an air shaft, and they trace her down to a little area. And at one point, you know, they try to cut through the decking. Good tension. We have the tracker again. The aliens are on their way, but, you know, the aliens are able to grab Newt. And Hicks and Ripley basically escape. He has to drag her because she wants to go after Newt. And Hicks is pretty much toast as they kill the last alien. It spews its blood all over his body armor, so he's kind of out of the fight. And then Bishop arrives with a dropship right at that moment. And, you know, Ripley makes the decision to stick around because Newt has the tracker and go get her. And now we get, you know, the piece de resistance. This is this belly of the beast section, as I like to call it, and then Ripley's about to descend into her nightmare, basically. You know, she tells Hicks not to let Bishop leave, and she does a loadout. But Newt is wearing her transponder, so she, you know, and she's still alive. Because Ripley knows that she's going to be, you know, stuck on the wall and put next to an egg to be implanted. So she's like, I'm going to get her. So we have this great moment where she loads out. She tapes a flamethrower together with a pulse rifle. So she's got these two guns together. And she grabs some flares. And she gets into an elevator that brings her down to the level of where the eggs are. In the elevator, we watch her load the grenade launcher. And she puts on this harness to put all this equipment. And then when she's done, it's this great moment where she just kind of closes her eyes, breathes, and then shakes her head, opens her eyes like she's fucking ready. Like, she's such a badass in this film in a great way without, you know, having to overdo it. I think in modern films now with female action heroes, sometimes they overdo the badassery. You know, I think it's perfect. You know, it's still, Weaver's vulnerable, you know, as a human being in all of this. She's not some steely-eyed badass who doesn't think and feel. Like, she's more of a badass because she feels, because we can see her inside. She's scared shitless, right? But she's doing it anyway, you know, that she's not completely, like, free of fear walking down there like, I will terminate you aliens. And I think that's the key to her character. Dispense is really off the charts. She's making her way into the place where the Marines got slaughtered. I mean, you can't really be more tense scene here. She finally finds Newt's locator beacon, but it had come off Newt's wrist, and she finds it on the ground. And she's, you know, as she's going there, she's leaving a trail for herself. Every turn she makes, she drops a flare, which is so cool. So she starts crying because she feels like now there's no way she can find Newt. So then the camera cuts to where Newt actually has been resined to the wall. And this egg is opening. Facehugger is starting to climb out. So she screams, and Ripley hears her, gets to her location just in time, shreds it with her pulse rifle, and then kills two aliens as well and pulls Newt out of the muck. Momentarily, because when she ran to Newt, she didn't drop any markers, so she's a little disoriented. She ends up in like the egg hatchery, like the main area where the eggs are being hatched. And so now we get this scene of the egg sack, and it's a great reveal, right? So first, we see the end of this weird kind of gross, odd tubule that's forming and laying the eggs as a kind of, you know, we see an egg and it pulls up. And then the camera slowly tracks back. We see, you know, several large places in this sort of tubular thing where eggs are being formed and they're moving along. It's a little like mini assembly line and dropping out. And then at the end of it is the queen. It's incredible. I mean, the design here is amazing. It's definitely not, you know, it's a little different than Giger. There are these huge head bones, massive, massive head, like much bigger than we've ever seen before. But it's got the double jaws, you know, and it's just an amazing, amazing. And it's real, you know, it's puppet moving stuff. So, you know, we really get a sense that it's really there. And the double jaws come out and it's really creepy and scary. We can see the way he shoots it. Like, you can see that the queen is motioning to the other drones to attack her. But so Ripley is able to do this like rude way of communicating with the queen. She shows her the flamethrower by kind of just shooting it off in the air. And then she points it at an egg. And then you see the queen call off the drones. Like, it's really, really sharply done. And so she's backing away with Newt on her back. But just as she's about to exit the egg area, she sees another egg opening. And she says, fuck it. She torches the whole field. She kills several of the aliens that are still there. And it makes sense that most of the aliens would be back in the, you know, where they left them across the compound, right? Otherwise, this whole place would be swarmed with aliens. There's only like a token force left back there. She kind of got back to the queen faster than the rest of the drones did, which is kind of, so it makes sense that there wouldn't be so many around. She kind of loses it and burns down her ammo and destroys all the eggs, then throws a bandolier of grenades into the area, blowing it all up, shooting grenades into the egg sacs as well. Like, she just guts the place. Even when it detonates, we can see the queen detaches from the one end of the tube and sets off in pursuit of Ripley. Now, you know, the tension's cranking up. Ripley follows the flares back to the elevators. You know, the elevator she was in had gone all the way back up to the top. I was like, why didn't you leave something in there, you know? So she has to wait for it. Classic horror movie trope. The suspense is really cranked up now because we hear the queen screaming in the distance. I mean, she's destroyed her entire brood, and she's coming for revenge. And she enters the area where the elevators are, and finally the elevator door opens, and for a split second it doesn't close right away, and she's screaming at it, and you're very tense. So she gets to the top of the area, this landing pad, and there's this brief false thing where, you know, the dropship's nowhere to be found, and she's screaming, and the place is coming down around her, and Cameron really waits. He waits it out. You know, it really takes a while, And you see the second elevator come up and the queen emerge. And it's pretty much curtains for her. And just in time, the dropship appears. The crew sort of ladder is down, so Ripley and Newt jump in. But it can't take off right away because it's one of its landing claws was sort of snagged on some debris, which in a sense gives you the later on when the queen emerges from the undercarriage, you realize that you know the dropship could take off right away. So there was a moment where it was stuck where the queen just kind of scampered out and jumped in you know, underneath. So it makes sense, actually. Finally, though, it rips away. You know, it gets to just above the clouds, and the reactor goes nuclear. Any other franchise or any other suspense horror movie, like, this would have been enough. It would have been a hell of an ending. And for all that tension, you know, I'm wrung out by the end of that, man. You know, Cameron has just wrung me out. But, you know, there is more to come. So there's this great sequence where it's very quiet, and, you know, Bishop standing there, had I do, Ripley did great. Suddenly, you know, something drops at Bishop's feet and starts to erode the deck. And then, you know, it's kind of like a psych-out chestburster scene because something comes bursting out of his chest, but it's actually the tail of the queen impaling Bishop right in the chest. And then it lifts him up and then tears him in half. Just really gross, creepy scene. All his white, you know, his white blood is kind of, you know, geysering out of him. And so down comes the queen, unfolds herself from the, you know, wherever she was. Ripley makes a break for it, tells Newt to run, and she secures herself in a cargo hold. And then we're pretty much focused on Newt, who's hiding under the decking plates, and the queen is just ripping them up. And, you know, it's only a matter of time before Newt gets gone, because she's just, you know, one step ahead of the queen who's pulling the plates up. And then this is Ripley's badass moment. The door opens in the cargo hold, the queen turns around, and Ripley emerges suited up in one of those exoskeleton power loaders, and the camera closes in. Get away from her, you bitch, you know, and it is on. Just think about how we got here, right? I mean, the fact that Ripley can use this machine, again, I think I said this earlier, but she can use this machine because she was cashiered and sent down to a lower rating and had to work the docks for however many months she had to work the docks at Gateway Station. But that saves her. It saves her, it saves Newt, it saves Hicks. You know, if you ignore Alien 3, which, you know, I'm happy to do at any given moment. But, you know, so when she uses this thing, it's not just some, like, you know, like she, we've never seen her use it before. There's no, and she already had used it when she helped the military kind of unload. So just how Cameron got here with her, that it was embedded in the story that she knows how to use this thing, is just pure genius. Like, I don't think he's ever been better than Aliens writing-wise. The fight is really cool. You know, she tags the queen a couple of times with the arms and knocks the queen down. And then at some point, the queen realizes that Ripley's kind of vulnerable in the cab, and she's stabbing her with her jaws, and Ripley's kind of barely getting out of the way. The queen tries to stab her with her tail. The second jaws are snapping at her and barely missing her. Really intense. And she remotely opens the airlock, and then we have this wonderful end game. And she grabs the queen with both of her pincers and is about to toss her into the lock. The airlock, and she does, but the queen grabs on to the exoskeleton, which is now overbalanced, and it falls on top of her. It really looks great here. The queen under that exoskeleton, boy, it looks really real. You know, and Ripley's now, it's the alien queen is pinned, so Ripley's climbing up the ladder. The queen grabs onto her foot, and she finally opens the airlock, and the exoskeleton gets sucked out, but the queen is still there, and, you know, all that's separating her from space is Ripley's foot. finally, it gets ripped out. She crawls up and hits the override. And finally, you know, as the audience, we can unclench ourselves after about, seriously, like an hour of continual tension. So then we have our brief coda, you know, back in the hibernation chambers. You know, she puts Bishop in one. She puts Hicks in another, who's unconscious. And then her and Newt are in one. And we are out. So a little bit of trivia about Aliens. Couple things I pulled off the web. The knife trick scene was not in the original shooting script. According to Lance Henriksen, the adding of Hudson's hand to the knife trick was discussed with almost everyone except Paxton. So I guess there was kind of a little on-set hijinks there. The alien nest set was kept intact after filming and was later used as the Axis Chemical set for the Batman film that came around in 1989, which is kind of interesting. When the Batman crew first entered the set, they found most of the alien nests still intact. I guess film's wrap, you know, I guess it must be the next incoming film which has to clear out the last thing. Al Matthews, I think I said this earlier, who plays the Apone, was a real-life Marine, the first black Marine to be promoted to the rank of sergeant in the field during his service in Vietnam, which I thought was really cool. Another bit, budget constraints meant that they could only afford to have 6 hypersleep capsules for the set scenes aboard the Sulaco, so they used mirrors and camera angles to make it look like there are way more. I think each sleep chamber cost $4,300 to build, which is wild. And so check this out. Hicks was originally played by an actor named James Remar. And I only know James Remar from 48 Hours. He's the bad guy in 48 Hours. He's been in a ton of stuff, obviously, in the 80s and 90s. But Michael Biehn replaced him a few days after principal photography began. The original reason given for Remar being removed is due to, quote, artistic differences between Remar and Cameron. But Remar says that he was fired from the production because he was busted for possession of drugs. So I guess Cameron did a nice thing and didn't say anything about it to anybody. And Remar said this was a period in his life where he had developed a really bad drug problem. He's in the finished film in one shot when the Marines enter the alien nest from behind. I guess they had shot that already. And because it's from behind, you can't tell that it's not Michael Biehn. So kind of interesting. According to Lance Henriksen, during the production of Aliens, the film Full Metal Jacket was also being shot at a nearby location. Because of this, the crews of each movie would gather together for parties, which I thought was kind of fun. So my summary of Aliens, an incredible film. I mean, just one of the greatest sci-fi action movies ever made. You know, I still am a big Alien fan. Like, I like Ridley Scott's first film, the best out of all the ones in the franchise. But this film is incredible. I mean, it does absolutely everything right. The casting is right. The tension, you know, you don't see too many aliens. You know, the Marines, you're escalating a lot of things from the first film. You know, you're escalating the number of aliens, obviously, but then you have the Marines to counterpoint them. You know, the tension is just incredible. You've got the facehuggers. You've got, instead of Ash, now you have Burke as the betrayer. You know, so Cameron definitely did his homework and used a lot of the tropes of the first film, but he did it in such a wonderful way that I think if you're ever going to do a sequel to a popular film, you could do worse than templating or seeing exactly what Cameron did. He must have diagrammed out Alien in such a wild way. And then each element that he thought really particularly worked, he, you know, molded into his sequel. Just a masterpiece all around. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page. And on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.